This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In Daniel Wallace's new novel, The Kings and Queens of Rome, storytelling again takes center stage. Storytelling was at the heart of Wallace's first novel, Big Fish, and the three books in between. In this latest, two sisters, Helen and Rachel McAllister, grow up in the town of Rome, spelled R-O-A-M. It's a town that has striking similarities with many towns in North Carolina. It was formerly dominated by textile manufacturing, though it was silk that made Rome's reputation, and it has fallen on hard times. This is Daniel Wallace's fifth novel. He is a professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He directs the creative writing program there and is sitting across the table with me right now. Daniel Wallace, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks. This is why I write books, just to get back here.
Just to get back here. That's great. Well, and you sell them, too. That's the other interesting thing, because they're good books. Tell us how this story developed.
It's kind of odd, because I had written the first paragraph of this book years ago, and I liked it. I had an idea there was something there, but I didn't know what it was. And so I finished Mr. Sebastian, my last book, and periodically I would go back to it and try to figure out what it was. And eventually I did. I started to see it started to suggest things to me. And after that, I was able to follow the story.
When it suggested things to you, and did those things create a narrative, or were they random things that you had to string together?
I had to string them together.
Yeah.
Even though my books are fantastic, in the sense that they're fantastical, that magical things happen
right.
In a normal world, everything happens logically. One thing leads to another. And so once I figure out what the inciting incident is and follow it, then it just is a logical progression throughout the rest of the book.
Yeah, ordinarily we would ask an author to give us a synopsis, or I would give it in the intro, but that doesn't work with your books in the sense that the synopsis isn't the point in a way. There is a story. It holds together. There's a structure, but it's all of the delightful dalliances and excursions along the way that are fabulous that make it a wonderful journey to read your books.
Mm-hmm. As the book progressed, I started to like the idea of thinking of it as a river, the main narrative as a river, and then having these little tributaries that come off of it and then flow back into it. I had a lot more of those in earlier drafts, and there were too many tributaries, so I had to cut a bunch of them.
Now, did you notice that, or was it an editor who said, Daniel?
Well, I think readers, that's really great to have readers that can tell you these things.
I just want to point out, I'm just going to read from the second paragraph a little bit, just to point out that a little bit of what I see in your work. They lived in a town called Rome, a town founded 100 years ago by their great-grandfather, Elijah McAllister, and his Chinese friend and hostage, Ming Kai, where they hoped to make the finest silk the world had ever known. So this little parenthetical phrase, this subjunctive clause, friend, or not really, it's just a little part of a phrase, and hostage.
Yes.
We don't get that explained for pages and pages and pages. And so what you realize is under the phrase and hostage, there is a whole story, and you can't help but try to go there as Daniel Wallace takes us along, or as the narration takes us along on a different path. It's wonderful.
Well, the idea for me in a book is to keep the reader reading, to keep them turning the pages. And that's really my ambition. If they can read it from beginning to end and like it, then my job is done.
But along the way, and here's the surprising thing, in order to keep you reading, I would think you'd want to keep that narrative kind of on its line. But these nested stories that you create are dangerous in a way, and they work so well in this book. I mean, is there a trick? When I read your book, I say to myself, how did he do that? How did he take me on this tangent, and I didn't get distracted and didn't say, what's that got to do with it? And only when I came back to the mainstream, to use your image, did I realize I'd been taken somewhere else.
Yeah, I can't tell you. If I told you, anybody could do it. It's very, it's a secret. I love language and character, and I feel like it's possible to create a character that, even though it's apart from the narrative or the main narrative, the reader can go with it. There's a lumberjack in the book, and once he came into the book, I followed him around for a while. And eventually, all these things feed into each other. Mm-hmm. You just have to believe in it long enough to get there.
Would you read for us?
Yeah, I will.
I'll let you set this up in any way you think is best.
Yeah, Marcus is a great-grandfather. Wants to go back to China. He's Chinese, and this is the hostage that we mentioned earlier. He's dying, and he wants to get back. And so his great-grandson, who loves him terrifically, starts to build him a boat. And this is in a valley miles and miles and miles from any kind of water. It took 5 years to build the boat, 5 years as Marcus and the three men cut and hewed and nailed and pounded and cursed and laughed. They made a clearing just 15 yards from Ming Kai's small hut, and they worked on the boat every day, even if some days it was just a little, just a nail or two. Edwin Korn knew something about boat building. He'd made a canoe once, many years before. He carved it out of a tree with a knife, a spoon, and a whole lot of muscle, but it worked. He and his father paddled around the big green lake in it. Then he built a raft by tying together a bunch of tree limbs with silk, and the raft floated well. He put his dog on it for a practice run, and the raft floated around the lake bend, out of sight, and when he finally found it lodged against the bank in a gnarled bunch of tree roots, his dog was gone, and he never saw him again. Then he built an actual boat, with a hull and a bow and sails and everything, everything a boat needs to be a boat. It was a miniature boat. He couldn't have even fit his dog in it if he still had a dog. He could only fit a palmetto bug. So he put the palmetto bug on the boat, tied it there with some silk, and launched it into the green. It floated away, moved quite nicely across the water. He could imagine, he said, that if the lake were the ocean and everything else was relative to it, his boat would be about the right size. Then the palmetto bug escaped, and when it jumped into the water, the boat capsized. A fish ate the bug, and the boat sank. These were some of the stories that were told while they were building the boat in the valley. At the end of the day, Marcus would report to Ming Kai on the progress they were making. "Today we cut the mast from a giant tree," he might tell him, or "we're working on the hull to make sure no water can get through the planks." Ming Kai nodded. Even with his eyes open, he appeared to be dreaming of the boat. He was dreaming the boat into existence. "There should be a bed on the boat," he said, "and a kitchen." "There will be," Marcus said. "I want a window in the hole, a place to watch the fish swim by." "That we have already done," said Marcus. "I want a carving of a beautiful woman on the bow," he said. "Of course," Marcus said. "Naked," Ming Kai said, "with lovely breasts, too big for my hands." "Yes," Marcus said. And then Ming Kai would close his eyes and sleep. Marcus had no intention of finishing the boat. Whenever they were almost done, Marcus would find some problem that needed to be addressed. The bed wasn't big enough, the masts insufficiently strong, and they would have to start over. 2 years after they'd begun, Juan Stone died. He fell and hit his head on a rock, and Edward Korn changed his mind, deciding he'd rather stay in the valley than take a chance on the high seas. Chang Perkins just got tired. But by that time, 4 years into the project, Marcus had learned enough to finish, or not to finish, the job himself. Finally, however, almost by accident, he did. Marcus hammered his last nail, smoothed his last plank, framed his last bulkhead. Though he had never seen a boat before, he could tell that this one could withstand the long journey to China, braving every wave and any harsh wind. The boat was perfect. With a piece of burnt wood, he wrote the word "home" on the top of the hull, wiped his hands on his shirt, and walked the 15 yards to tell Ming Kai the news. His boat was ready.
Daniel Wallace reading from his latest novel, The Kings and Queens of Rome. We talked about Homer in our last segment, and there we go. Another reference to the Odyssey itself.
Right.
Doing and undoing.
Yeah, I think consciously or unconsciously, and in my case unconsciously, I am drawn to certain themes, and they excite me. And Greek myth, those stories, just have become embedded in me. And when I'm writing, they arrive.
Find their way. So we should tell – I'll talk a little bit more about this story, though. I won't have you do a whole summary. But we do have at the center of this two twin sisters, one blind, one sighted. The blind twin is quite beautiful. The sighted sister, not so much. Mm-hmm. But because she has vision, she's the one who's in control of the narrative, right, and tells awful stories to her sister about herself.
Yeah. It's all about storytelling and what you believe. And she has power because she is in control of the story. And her beautiful little sister goes through most of her life believing that the world is a dark and terrible place, that she's epically ugly, and that the only person in the world that cares for her or ever could care for her is her cruel older sister.
This is a place where we will recognize as North Carolinians to some degree because it's a textile town fallen on hard times. And yet it feels to me like the book is deliberately not in a particular place or a particular time. I identify with the individual characteristics of the place, but it doesn't have a time or place. Is that important to you in this book?
It is. Specificity in a book like this is incredibly important, but it's specificity of the world that these characters live in, the town, what it looks like, what's going on there. But for me, I didn't think that the time or place was important, that what happens within the covers of the book could happen anytime, anywhere. There are things that weird kind of almost parallel universe events where there's some technology that normally wouldn't be there at this juncture. There's a television and there are horses. People ride around. So it's a world that could only take place within this book. But I didn't want to zero in on any particular time or place to specify it because I felt that was exclusionary more than including the reader in anything that's important. In Big Fish, for instance, I did the same similar thing with the father who's dying. I never say what he's dying of, and I don't think it's important what he's dying of.
But the anachronism is fun and effective in a way. If anybody recalls the wonderful TV series Briscoe County Jr., mm-hmm, they'll know what I'm talking about. But there's a way that you really engage because you've got me working overtime to kind of put these things together, and it seems to open a space in my own consciousness when I'm reading to allow more of this good stuff in, especially mm-hmm when it's fabulous. I mean, we have ghosts, for instance, in this book.
Yeah, the ghosts arrived later, I would say in about the third draft. There were no ghosts initially. And during the course of writing this book, which took me a lot longer than most books and was much more difficult to write, four people really close to me died. And they influenced in a really, really big way this book and the writing of it. And the ghosts are what ghosts usually are, I think, in most stories. They're the past, they're memory, they're the inescapability of the emotions which were always a part of the living. And so we talk about influence with writers, and usually we talk about other writers that you've read that influence. But it's really, to me, it's your life. It's the things that you experience that you bring to the story, and these deaths really did.
Did the addition of these ghosts radically change the storyline, the book itself?
Yeah, it did. There's a character, Digby, who is the bartender. The fact that he can see the ghosts and almost nobody else can was a really important detail, and I think was illuminated who he was in a way that he wasn't before. Whereas before, initially, he was just an interesting guy, a fun guy to be around. When the ghost came and he was able to talk to them and see them and understand them, his character just it became so much deeper, and he became a much bigger part of the book.
Did that make you have to go back and change other interactions that he'd have earlier in the book?
Well, yeah, that's the beauty of being a writer, is that you can go back and change it. Nothing is settled. It's settled now,
right.
But there's, you know, even when I was reading the passage I did, I was editing it and seeing things that I wish that I could still change. But c'est la vie.
You can do that in the next book. But speaking of the next book, let's talk about the first book, Big Fish. First the novel, then the movie, now a musical on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. That was my plan all along.
What? How does that work now? Are you brought into that at all, or are you out of it?
No, I think you had as much influence on it as I did, which is none. I feel like essentially that I've, in writing a book, I've created the thing that I know how to. And what happens after that is out of my hands. I don't know anything about making a movie. I don't know anything about making a musical. Just keep my fingers crossed that it's in the hands of some very smart, creative people. And in this case, it really is. I'm really pleased with the show. I didn't know my characters could sing and dance
quite as well. Well, it'll be fun to see them when they're on the stage, and no doubt will make their way into this area.
We hope.
Daniel, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Daniel Wallace is a professor of English at UNC Chapel Hill, head of the creative writing program, and his latest novel is called The Kings and Queens of Rome, R-O-A-M. For more information about that, you can go to our website, wnc.org. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.